Hello? Okay. It's for you, James.
Hey, James. This is James from the future.
Just wanted to give you a call and let you know that...
Puberty can be tough, but you can get through it.
So I just wanted to let you know that everything's going to be okay and...
I love you.
You got the wrong number.
I grew up in a generation where smartphones were a new thing and everyone in my class had one, except for me. My parents never got me one because they didn't want me to access the internet on a device that could fit in my pocket because they were super strict and didn't want me looking at... internet stuff?
Which backfired horribly.
So they never gave me a smartphone. In fact, I didn't even get my first cell phone until I was 16 years old. Now, as an adult who uses a cell phone every day, I don't know how I survived for 16 years without one. I think when I was younger, if I was ever in a situation where I needed to call my parents, I would just ask the nearest person if I could borrow their phone. Now, if there's any parents watching this who haven't given their children a cell phone yet, take it from a guy on the internet with no children. You should get them one. It doesn't have to be a smart one, you can just give them your standard drug dealer phone, but you should at least give them a cell phone in case there's an emergency and they need to call you or the police. The only downside I can think of giving your child a phone is they'll end up spending too much time on it, so you should just turn off their service from time to time, I don't know. When I turned 16 and finished up my sophomore year of high school, I got my very first cell phone. An LG Cosmos 2.
I didn't grow up in the 90s. Everyone else had iPhones, but I was the only one with a phone that had a keyboard on it.
And with that cell phone, I've had a couple of incidences where sometimes a random person would call me thinking I was someone else and then wouldn't admit they're wrong. And that's how you segue into the theme of this month's video. This first story happened when I was working at Subway. That's right, another Subway story. Hashtag Subway 4. It wasn't good enough to be in the other three. So, it was 5 minutes until closing, and we get a phone call on the Subway phone. I pick it up and say, Thank you for calling Subway. How may I help you? I was supposed to say, this is James. How may I help you? But I wasn't about to tell this random stranger my name.
Idiot.
Anyway, the other person on the line said, hey, what time do you guys close? In 5 minutes. Is it alright if I show up late? I just need gas. And being the good employee that I was totally willing to make this guy's sandwich over the phone, let him pick it up after we closed, and then I wouldn't ring him up and just pocket the money. I'm just kidding. I wouldn't do that. That's a crime. Please don't sue me. So I said, yeah, I can do that. What kind of sandwich do you want? And he said, I just need gas. Oh, don't worry, sir. This sandwich will give you plenty of gas. I mean, do you want chips or something? No, he said. I just need gas. I was a little confused. Okay, yes. So you'll get gas, then are you gonna stop by and pick up a sandwich? And he said, I don't want a sandwich. And then it hit me. Even though the first thing I ever said to this guy was, thank you for calling Subway, I think he thought he was talking to a gas station. So I said, sir, this is a Subway?
Oh.
And I never got the chance to tell him that gas pumps don't close. This next story happened when I was at home and I got a call from a number I didn't recognize. Now, I've had friends tell me that they don't answer the phone to any number they don't recognize, but my anxiety won't let me do that. What if it's your bank calling saying your account got hacked? What if it's your grandma? Because why would you have her saved in your phone? Or what if it's your Nigerian uncle who wants to give you his collection of gold bars and needs your information for a wire transfer? You just never know, so I always pick up the phone. So I answered it, and it was this woman asking for a Lawrence. And I said, oh, I'm not... You have the wrong number. And she goes, isn't this 416-295? That's obviously not a real number, so don't try calling it. And I said, no, this is 416-293, because that's my phone number. Again, that's not actually a valid phone number, so please don't call it. And she goes, 3? I don't think I pressed 3. And I don't know what to say to this woman, because my number is 416-293. It's really not. But she doesn't think she pushed 3. So I don't know how she's talking to me right now, unless she did. So I said, well, obviously,
You did. And then I made a comic about the whole situation because I thought the internet would think it was funny. This next story happened not too long ago. I got a call from a number I didn't recognize at 9:30 in the morning, and I was lying in my bed, asleep. And most people would agree that you're supposed to be awake and productive at 9:30. And I didn't want whoever this stranger was thinking I'm lazy, so I had to answer the phone with my best, I've been awake for several hours voice. Hello?
You're going to have to come quickly! Timmy fell down the well, Vance!
What?
I said, you're going to have to come quickly because Timmy fell down the well, Vance!
I could tell it was a woman on the phone, but it was either her accent or the phone being buggy or I just had woken up, but I could not understand anything she was saying. But I could make out one word, which was Vance. So, I did not have a lot to go off of. I said,
I think you have the wrong number.
Okay. Goodbye.
No, I got the phone. You gotta come quickly, because Timmy fell out.
Well, I should probably get the day started, I thought as I went back to sleep. But then immediately, I got a call from the same number. And I thought, okay, maybe if this person is calling again, even after I explicitly told her she had the wrong number, maybe it's not a wrong number after all. Maybe there's something else going on. Maybe it's an emergency, so maybe, talk to me. Okay, I can't understand anything you're saying. So then this woman must have handed the phone to her friend because a different voice started talking and I could actually understand her and I'll never forget what she said, which was,
Vance, no one thinks
that you're funny.
And even though I'm not Vance, that kinda hurt. So I stated the obvious, which was, yes I am, and also I'm not Vance. And she said,
no, Lance.
So this whole time, these two have been looking for a Lance. So I told this woman, I'm not Lance either. And she said,
well, this is the number they gave me.
Okay, if she had said it like, oh, I'm sorry, this is the number they gave me, I didn't mean to call you, stranger. Also, I do think you're funny and enjoy your videos, then that would have been totally fine. She's just shifting the blame to someone else. But instead, she sounded so condescending, like I was wasting her time. Well, this is the number they gave me, and they can't be wrong, so you must be the real Lance. So I said,
well, they must have given it to you wrong.
Look, I'm too tired to be polite. But then, she hung up on me. Like, this woman just basically called a random person, said, you're not funny, and then hung up. So I decided to call her back and said, hey, I just found the real Lance. He's the funniest guy I ever met, and he told me he doesn't give his phone number out to rude pieces of shit. I'm just kidding on that last part. I thought about doing it, but then I went back to sleep. I didn't do it. And then someone on the internet found my phone number, and I changed it. And whoever has my old number is probably getting a lot of calls from strangers and people I went to high school with. Sorry about that.
Juan Ponce de Leon was famously known for searching for the legendary Fountain of Youth with his crew in the 1500s. Spoiler alert, he didn't find it, obviously, because he's dead, I think. But his search might have been successful if only he lived in the 21st century. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that we have the key to immortality right in our grocery stores. And it all starts with this tiny red bottle of 5-hour energy. So drinking one of these gives you 5 hours of energy. So that means drinking two will give you 10 hours, right? It takes 17,520,000 hours to make up 2,000 years. And here's how we unlock our immortality. To get 17 million hours of energy, we would have to drink 3,504,000 bottles of 5-hour energy. After you do all that, you have enough energy to last the next 2,000 years. And there you go, that's how you live forever. Every 2,000 years, you just drink 3 million bottles of 5-hour energy. And what, that's 12 ounces a bottle divided by 128. So that's only 328,500 gallons of 5-hour energy, and boom. So it's not really a fountain of youth, it's more of a pond of youth. And you have to drink all that 5-hour energy every 2,000 years. It's not going to be forever. And it might take a while, so just set aside like an afternoon and just get sipping. Wait, hold on. If each bottle is $2.50, then how much would it cost? 8.7 million? Dang it! Only the rich get to live forever! Okay, guys, never mind. I guess immortality is impossible. Ugh, just looks like all of us are gonna have to die.
This brick is alive. Not convinced? Well, what if I did this?
I'm gonna do a backflip!
That's gonna look so cool, Brickathy!
What are you boys doing?
Brickathy's gonna do a backflip, Grandma!
Are you convinced now? Did the brick feel more alive? I mean, sure, it's still a brick that can't move on its own, but maybe because I put googly eyes on it and gave it a family, you can connect with this brick, and it made you feel emotions. Convincing you that something inanimate is animate is the main goal of the animate ore. They're nothing more than deranged frauds. For the last century, animators have innovated new techniques and styles to this medium, taking it from a spinning wheel that doesn't even use electricity to Spider-Verse. And today, I'm going to talk about all the processes and innovations that have brought the medium of animation to right now. But first, let's go all the way back to the beginning of film, when it was all black and white and people had to put up text whenever they talked. Early on, filmmakers discovered a very simple trick to make anything appear alive in front of a camera. And that simple trick was called... You're filming something, and then stop the camera, and then move the thing slightly, capture a new image, move the thing again, and continue to do that a tedious amount of times. On the film, that thing now magically looked like it move on its own. And with this technique, you could make literally anything appear to be moving. Anything. But some filmmakers took this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters out of clay and a posable metal wire system called an armature. Now animators can sculpt unique characters that bend and pose in much more believable ways. With stop motion, you don't need to hire a real dinosaur or giant monkey to make a movie about a dinosaur or giant monkey. I'm sorry you didn't get the job, Phil. You know, I just had a crazy idea. What if we made our entire puppet's head interchangeable? Now they can make any facial expression and mouth shape possible. We will have to sculpt out hundreds of different heads, though, but, I mean, come on, that'll be fun. That's why we're extreme, baby! Stop-motion movies are still being made and enjoyed to this day, and while new technology does help make the overall process easier, animators are still using the same techniques that were used on King Kong back in the 1920s, where they carefully pose out a character's every movement frame by frame. In order. Stop motion is a medium that I can't even begin to understand how they do, let alone make it look good, you know? Having a stop motion character in gravity-defying poses, making hundreds of different faces, is done solely to make the character feel more alive. And sometimes, to help sell the realism, animators will mimic quirks that only happen in live-action films. I always chuckle when I see a lens flare in an animated movie, because, like, where did you come from? There's not even a camera lens. Unlike me, though, who's always got a camera rolling. Hey, how's it going? Uh-oh. Oh, no! Did you catch that? Did you see the lizard eating a bug? Ooh, we got him. Now let's rewind the clip and pause right here. This lizard moves so fast that the camera can't even capture its movements correctly, and he transmogrifies into an amorphic blob that barely even resembles a lizard. But do not fret, dear viewer. This is called motion blur, and it's absolutely natural. Fast-moving objects are hard to see in real life anyway, so this blurry blob only showing up for one frame actually helps sell the idea that this little guy is moving quickly. If you watch any movie frame by frame, you'll find motion blur everywhere, and you won't even notice. So how do animators who are taking hundreds of still photos handle this naturally occurring phenomenon with things in motion? Easy, they'll draw smear. Animators draw their own blurry blob frame to mimic fast movements. Bodies can stretch, arms can multiply. Basically, we can sneak in nightmares as long as it's only shown for one frame. Smears, while being very fun to draw, can look very weird and goofy on their own. But in the context of the whole shot, you barely even notice they're there. Okay, maybe now you'll notice them, but that's only because I pointed them out. And since animators are bad boys and don't play by the rules, they can make smears out of anything,
Even in stop motion, we can sculpt a physical smear frame like how they did in Leica's Paranorman, which, if you haven't seen, is going to be your new favorite movie. Smear frames can be used anytime, anywhere. Unless you were an animator in the 1920s and 30s and you didn't know about them back then. In that case, you would have been animating something called... In the 1920s and 30s, animators were still figuring out some core principles of animation. Turns out there's 12 of them. Smear frames were used sparingly during this time, with animators usually only drawing characters with multiple limbs to show fast movements. The stretchy, wacky, and spiritually ascending smears that you all know and love weren't really used until the 1940s. Rubber hose characters have noodly, almost hose-like limbs that bend in all sorts of anatomically defying ways. Look at Mickey Mouse's noodle arms that I can now legally show you. The reason characters look like this is because drawing noodle arms and not worrying about anatomy is easier to draw. But like, just because something has noodle arms doesn't mean it's bad, you guys. What these animators were able to accomplish with the technology, if you could even call it that, is nothing short of dark magic. And the very same studio that made Steamboat Willie wanted to push the envelope and show the world that animation could be more. It doesn't just have to be noodly characters with Pac-Man eyes. They were going to animate a realistic woman with proportional arms that don't move in weird, exaggerated ways. And oh god, her noodle arms are moving in weird, exaggerated ways. In 1934, Disney released a short called The Goddess of Spring, being their first attempt at animating a character with what was supposed to have real human anatomy. They still had a lot to learn, obviously. Now, animating a quote-unquote anatomically correct human is actually a much harder task than you might realize. And that's because of the uncanny valley. Get more and more human characteristics, we hit an interesting point right here when something looks almost like a human, but is just a little off. Our pattern recognition brains start setting off alarm bells and go, ugh, something is definitely wrong with that almost human. I am entering fight or flight right now. So if you're trying to make something look as close to a human as possible, but are just a tiny bit off, everything crumbles. The Goddess of Spring was still good practice for Disney because only 3 years later, they released the world's first fully animated feature film, Snow White. Can you really blame Disney for going 6 times over budget to make this movie? I mean, just look at how these human characters are moving. 10 years before Snow White, animated humans looked like this. So going from this to this in only 10 years? How? I can't get over how real these human characters look sometimes. Almost too real. Well, I think you're old enough to learn about the dangers of rotoscoping is the process of taking real-life footage and then manually tracing over every frame, resulting in an animation with unreal levels of realism. And I say unreal derogatorily. You're basically slapping a cartoon filter over live-action footage, but instead of simply slapping, you're spending multiple hours doing mindless and tedious drawing. Rotoscoping is not the same as filming a human actor and then later referencing that footage, like what Disney did for Sleeping Beauty or Alice in Wonderland or any movie ever, because animators use references all the time. People had figured out how to rotoscope other people long before Snow White. So of course Disney, who was trying to convey real human movement, rotoscoped some shots. The problem with rotoscoping is that we start to sneak our way back to the bottom of the uncanny valley. Animated characters often do and should break the laws of physics. They can squash and stretch into weird proportions and be drawn in unique and interesting poses. And look, Snow White is still a masterpiece of a movie. The rotoscoping is fine, you barely notice it. It's good, it's a good movie, and it made Disney a lot of money. Also, how did Walt animate these shots of things reflecting in the water in 1937? What, did they put special glass over paintings to make it look distorted or something? Who would be crazy enough to do that? If you made a whole movie entirely rotoscoped, what you end up with is Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings. Notice anything off about these characters' movements? Look at how Gandalf moved just a year ago in The Hobbit. Now, Lord of the Rings. Hobbit. Lord of the Rings. Almost every shot in this movie was rotoscoped. And the shots that weren't used live-action footage with a filter over it. I'm not saying that rotoscoping is bad. You just have to use it correctly. A character switching from traditionally animated to rotoscoped is incredibly funny, and always will be. The YouTuber Joel Havier makes very entertaining rotoscope skits that feel like a fever dream, and I mean that underogatorily. And a lot of music videos get away with rotoscoping because, admittedly, rotoscoping is a very cool visual. Now, I wish I could say the first Lord of the Rings movie was a hidden animation gem, but I don't know, it's not on my top 10, I'm sorry. It probably made a lot of nerds in the 70s happy, but thankfully The Lord of the Rings has been adapted into many other forms of media, like video games, Magic the Gathering cards, and anime.
Anime?
They're making a Lord of the Rings anime?
They're making a Lord of the Rings...
You thought Hollywood, California was the only place in the world making moving pictures? Japan's been making their own moving pictures too, and some of them are moving drawings. There are entire college courses on the history of anime, but you're not paying me tuition, so we're gonna have to skip over a couple things. A lot of early anime is now lost media because cinemas didn't preserve film back then, and an earthquake destroyed many studios in 1923. Some Japanese animators created shorts out of paper cutouts because buying thousands of celluloid sheets was too expensive, and they had some very unique character designs. And some Japanese animators took inspiration from Disney and made shorts that looked very similar to America's rubber hose characters. Then, by the 1940s, some major world events happened that got most of the world involved, and both American and Japanese animation studios were affected. But after all that, in 1948, one studio called Japan Animated Films, later bought out by Toei Animation, set out to be the Disney of the East, and they made cartoons about magical schoolgirls, and are still in business to this day and made some other less popular shows. One animator who quit working at Toei created his own company and made an anime based off his comic about a robot boy. Hey, I kinda like that art style of drawing humans with big expressive eyes. Let's do more of that. That same year, another studio made an anime about humans controlling giant robots. I wonder if that's going to inspire a whole new genre. And this guy was commissioned by American studios to make stop-motion Christmas movies like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Meaning Rudolph is anime.
Nani?
By the 1960s, Japanese shows started airing on televisions all across the globe, and they continued to make unique and interesting stories with amazing animations that were beloved by billions of people and grew into extremely profitable franchises. Like, I'm talking the most profitable franchise. By the 1970s, Disney was still very much the animated movie gold standard, making big-budgeted movies with family-friendly values. Which is fine to do, kids love bright colors and talking animals that only cartoons can offer, but some studios realized that animation was a medium, not a genre, and made animated movies exclusively for adults. That's part of the reason why the first Lord of the Rings movie was entirely rotoscoped. It wasn't trying to be cartoony and over the top, it was trying to be real and gritty. Animation could be anything for anyone of any age. But really, if you think about it, there hadn't been a new way of showing people moving drawings since those very early days of black and white stop motion. In stop motion, you take a picture, move a figure, take a picture, move a figure. In cell animation, you take a picture, move a cell, take a picture, move a cell. Everything's just been a series of pictures moved manually in front of a camera this whole time? Always has been.
You've got mail.
Oh. It says the entire animation and film industry is about to be flipped onto its head forever and ever. Yeah, right. I'm sure this whole computer thing is just... Ever-increasing advancements of technology, we were able to achieve increasingly advanced... achievements, like putting a guy on the moon, and drawing silly little cartoons more efficiently. Gone are the days of having to physically draw everything out on paper and underpay a team of hundreds of pretty girls to hand-paint every frame. Now we can use this fancy new computer to render everything out for us. All we have to do is create a real-life mold of our real-life human hand, then draw 350 triangles onto that hand, then manually measure out the X, Y, and Z coordinates of 800 different data points. No, come on, this is gonna be so much faster. Put that pencil down. Now we just program in a couple of keyframes and we get... Huh. We still don't have the processing power to render everything out. Oh, I know. We'll just point this long exposure camera at the computer screen. Get these art supplies out of here. This is the future. And when everything's finished rendering, we'll get this. A whole human hand moving on its own without having to draw a single frame. This process is exactly what Utah University student Ed Catmull did in 1972. And while it might not have been more efficient than drawing everything out by hand, it showed that computers were capable of rendering out three-dimensional animations. This was made after we landed a man on the moon, by the way, so don't tell me this was CGI. As the computer's processing power grew exponentially, more and more filmmakers started seeing the benefits of using computer-generated images in movies. A decade after Catmull digitized his hand, films like Tron showcased characters racing on mind-boggling computer-generated light cycles. This might look, you know, bad by today's standards, but these graphics were something that audiences had never seen before. Plus, the movie takes place inside of a computer, so this is probably what people thought the insides of a computer looked like anyways. At the time, computers did a great job at creating rigid, geometric shapes, and animators used that to their advantage. Characters would still have to be animated traditionally on cells, but objects that weren't going to change shape, like black cauldrons, could now magically fly in circles around our characters. Disney really showed off the computer's rendering power during the climax of The Great Mouse Detective, when these two rodents fought each other inside a clock tower and all the spinning gears were generated by a computer. Animators can now make any complex shape move in a three-dimensional space without having to draw a single frame. I mean, you know, except for the characters, they still very much had to draw those. Computer graphics were here to stay as Disney integrated more of them into movies like these cars in Oliver and Company or Eric's ship in The Little Mermaid, and then they stopped using cells entirely. Starting with The Rescuers Down Under, Disney no longer used cells and made movies entirely digitally with a program called CAPS. So if you ever wanted to own a cell of Joanna the Lizard eating an egg, that's too bad because they don't exist. Which fucking sucks because Joanna was the best goddamn lizard Disney ever made. Don't touch me! TV shows and anime still use cells till about the year 2000-ish, but eventually everyone switched to digital. Now to color a frame, all you had to do was... So computers were great at making rigid, non-flexible shapes, but has anyone ever tried to make... A group of computer scientists who were working for a small indie director named George Lucas were taking this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters completely generated by a computer. Then a small entrepreneur named Steve Jobs hired those computer scientists and made his own company, Pixar. Yes, Steve Jobs was one of the founders of Pixar, and he originally created the company to sell a high-end computer powerful enough to render 3D animations. But no one bought the computer because it cost $135,000. So the team scrapped the computer selling idea and just stuck with making computer-generated cartoons. But they soon discovered a unique problem. The computer had a hard time getting textures right, and everything, including babies, ended up looking like it was made out of plastic. So the team's clever work around this dilemma was to make a movie with the entire cast of characters actually made out of plastic. Or ants. You know, people don't know what ants are supposed to look like. It's fine. Pixar continued to develop new processes to get the computer to generate unique textures and lighting, like simulating human hair or fur, or lighting things in such a way to make everything appear underwater. No other studio was pioneering computer-generated images like Pixar was. And then in 2006, Disney bought Pixar. But I don't think Steve was too upset because 1 year later, he achieved his dream of selling a high-end computer. This time being a little more affordable. A little. Now, I want to squash any misconception that computers do all the animating. Animators still have to manually pose a character's body and facial expression off of a character's... build a complex system of nodes and bones that let them manually pose a character into any position possible. It's kind of like a digital stop-motion puppet, or an actual puppet without any of the strings. All CG characters are just their own complicated version of Pinocchio. Using character rigs is really the only way of animating things in three dimensions, But it's not like we can use rigs in 2D animation. Here in the second dimension, we don't have a fancy Z-axis. 2D animation can only be done by hand-drawing 24 new images every second. Except we don't, I lied. Even all the way back when characters were animated with paper and cells, animators wouldn't draw a whole new frame every frame. Usually, they would animate pieces of a character and paint each piece on its own cell. You remember Robin? They only drew one body and five different heads. But because cells are a physical object that get harder to handle the more you have, animators could only break a character up into two or three different pieces. But now, thanks to the computer, we can break up a character into as many pieces as we'd like. Like, four. Or five. Or 173! Have you ever played around with the free and revolutionary animation software Pivot Stick Figure Animator? If you're the type of person that says, "Oh, I suck at drawing. I can't even draw stick figures," then you're gonna love this program. On Pivot, you're given a pre-made stick figure or horse that have these joints that can be posed however you like. Each of these stick figure's limbs are just individual pieces that are connected in such a way that make it look like a stick figure. So to make these animations, we're not really drawing anything, we're just manually posing out a character like a digital puppeteer. I wasn't saying you can make a rig out of 173 pieces just to be funny. Because that's how many pieces I'm made out of. That's right, me. Even I'm a rig. And can I tell you a secret? Most TV shows use rigs too. Of course, hand-drawn traditional animation is still used to make these shows. It's not a lost art form or anything. But rigs are super useful at making still pretty high-quality levels of animation, but at a much cheaper cost. And as we all know, TV animation has to create more animation per budget. But maybe rig animation still isn't as cost-effective as you'd like. And maybe you're not a fan of the complicated puppet look, and you want something that looks more human. Well, there's one more animation process we can try, called motion. An actor inside one of these dorky ping-pong suits, a computer can pinpoint and record that actor's exact movements. Now we can take those movements, slap a cartoon character's model over it, and we get an animation that looks like... shit. Motion capture is the rotoscoping of 3D animation. It cuts costs, but the results are too human, and we're back at the bottom of the uncanny valley. That's why the kids from the Polar Express look so nightmarish, because they are following the exact movements of Tom Hanks. Yes, Tom Hanks, the adult man, did some motion capture for the small, nameless hero boy from the Polar Express. There's probably a reason we haven't made a fully motion capture cartoon in over 10 years. Because it looks weird. But I mean, that didn't stop one of these movies from winning an Oscar in animation. And before you ask, no, it wasn't Monster House or Tintin. It was Mars Needs Moms, duh. Just like rotoscoping, motion capture can be used correctly. Computer-generated characters acting side-by-side real human actors look decent. It's not that jarring that these creatures who exist in a live-action world are moving just like live-action people. And let's not forget all the VTubers who use motion capture technology to bring their jiggly assets to life. No matter what method someone uses to try and convince you that something else is alive, I think is incredibly cool, and I hope you think it's cool too. But maybe you don't think it's cool, and you don't care about animation, and you just put this video on in the background while you were cleaning. That's totally fine, I do that all the time. I just like learning about how all of my favorite animated pieces of media get created, because it's not always the same process. And I think it's great that new technology is allowing anyone to express themselves in whatever way possible. A person expressing themselves. Those are the three key words here. From the big studios that are just now pioneering new and interesting styles with digital animation, to the indie studios that have access to incredible technology which allow anyone working from their bedrooms in their pajamas to create some truly masterpieces of animation. So, if you're the type of person that likes to trick people into thinking that something is alive, then you deserve all the respect in the world. In fact, here are some cool people that made the animation in this video possible. Hello, you just made it to the end of this video. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm still trying to figure out this VTuber model, so I'm over-enunciating my words. The technology behind this is beyond my comprehension.
If you're still deciding what to get for the holidays, then great news. We have mystery boxes over on my website, so you can leave the deciding up to us. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go take a nap. Are you still watching? Oh yeah, she's coming back.
I understand that there are things that I don't understand. For example, theoretical physics or how to make friends. But I do know that the world is not flat, that vaccines work, and listening to people tell me otherwise is admittedly a guilty pleasure of mine. Whether it's conspiracy theories or horoscopes, I love watching people pour their heart into something they genuinely believe in, only for me to go, "I disagree." But please continue. There are some beliefs that I don't agree with, but are absolutely fine to believe in, like thinking bucket hats look good on someone. But I think we can all agree that some beliefs can be incredibly damaging to a person or even humanity as a whole, like the anti-vaxxers or racists. So I discovered a new trend, and I'm not sure if it's just kids being kids or a mentally damaging belief system, but I'm still gonna talk about it and explain to my audience the importance of critical thinking and to notice the red flags and dangerous beliefs. So what am I talking about? I unfortunately fell down a rabbit hole and discovered a community of mostly kids on a phone application called TikTok doing something called reality shifting. This, by the way, is not a small community of like 20 people. There are amino groups with thousands of members, videos with hundreds of thousands of views, and they have their own acronyms. OMG. Reality shifting stems from the belief in parallel universes, which I gotta be honest, I'm not completely sold on that idea to begin with. You say that Schrodinger's cat is both alive and dead, but cats have 9 lives, so are 4.5 cats dead? How is a cat half dead? Either way, someone supposedly very smart has said that every decision you've ever made has caused the universe to copy itself and create a new reality where you made the different decision. I had cereal for breakfast this morning, but somewhere there's a reality where I ate my hamster for breakfast. Does that mean I create a new universe every time I scratch my butt, and somewhere there's a James with better manners? So times that by 8 billion people making decisions every day, plus the decisions made by, like, dogs and jellyfish, right? Those count, I think. And we get roughly infinity total realities. If you've seen Endgame, you know what I'm talking about. The reality shifting community says that since there are infinite realities, then there's a reality where GameStop stock is incredibly low, or that COVID didn't happen. Or perhaps there's even a reality out there where Hogwarts is real, and a messenger owl just dropped off your acceptance letter. And through the right meditation, you can transfer your consciousness from your current reality, your CR for short, to your Hogwarts desired reality, your DR. And for some gosh darn reason, Hogwarts is the number one shiftable destination location. But obviously, it's not just Hogwarts. Any fictional universe is fair game. You could go to the Hunger Games or Lord of the Rings. I'm not sure why, though. A lot of bad things happen there. And since all logic is thrown out the window, cartoon and anime realities are shiftable destinations. Because if Schrodinger's cat taught us anything, it's that there are some universes that are just 24 drawings a second. So because there are allegedly infinite realities, people will write down what they want their desired reality to be, and this is called a script. It's funny, you know, normally scripts are made to tell fictional stories, but these people think that what they write down will be 100% real. And you can make a script of whatever you want. You can say, "I want to shift to Hogwarts and be in a relationship with Draco Malfoy." I mean, not me, this is just an example. Now listen, you're a smart kid, okay? Hopefully, I don't have to explain to you that that's not how life works. If you believe you can hop into different realities, then that's great and I see no problem with it. Is what I would say in a different reality, but in this reality, I have a lot of questions. If you can shift your consciousness into a different version of you, what happens to the alternate reality you's consciousness? You're just taking over someone else's body. This other you had a life and a family, unless you're going to a YA fantasy novel, and you just took over their whole body. What if there's a you in an alternate reality that's like, "I want to live in a reality where there's a pandemic and I'm sadder," and then they shifted here? What happens to your consciousness? You don't trade. The reality shifting community says that when you shift, you leave behind a clone of yourself. Obviously. So when you shift, there's someone's consciousness
unaccounted for!
What about the realities where one of you had waffles for breakfast and the other had pancakes? Both of these yous are pretty much the exact same, so then both of you will want to reality shift to the exact same Harry Potter reality. Do you have to share a body with the other yous that have shifted to the same reality? Are you telling me that Voldemort and any fictional villain is real? How come half of us didn't get turned to dust when Thanos snapped? If anyone can reality shift, are you telling me there's a chance that Voldemort could download TikTok and reality shift here? If you go to Hogwarts, you're leading Voldemort right to us. How can there be a reality where magic is real? Sure, I don't know how parallel universes work, but they're parallel, so the laws of physics should still be the same, right?
But James, I know that reality shifting makes no sense and is impossible, but then why do so many people claim to have shifted?
Because they're dreaming. Shifting happens when you fall asleep, and if you fill your subconscious with things from your desired reality, would you be surprised that you had a dream about Hogwarts? Something about this trend doesn't sit right with me. A lot of the reality shifting TikToks were done by kids, and kids, as you know, can get really obsessed in the fandom and do some cringy stuff. If these kids were making fanfiction and writing themselves on a date with Bakugo, that would be totally fine. Healthy even. Heck, even if these kids flat out said, "I love Harry Potter so much that I want to manipulate my dreams to be about him," that would be fine too! But something about actually believing that you're astral projecting into a fictional universe? I don't know, that level of obsession just feels unhealthy, my guy. And also, back off Bakugo, he's mine. The problem with reality shifting and actually conspiracy theories as a whole is that they pretend to be based on factual evidence when they're entirely a pseudoscience. You start off with a scientific idea, multiple realities, and then you make up whatever you want and use what the scientists have said about multiple realities as proof. Even though no scientist has said anything about being able to move your consciousness outside of your body, or that you leave a clone of yourself behind when you reality shift, or that cartoon universes exist, I've seen people in videos say that they've done research on reality shifting, but I feel confident in saying you didn't get a degree in quantum physics. I want you to cite your sources and show me the studies, because research isn't just believing what other people said on TikTok. These TikToks get impressionable kids to believe in reality shifting in pretty manipulative ways, saying that if you didn't shift, it's because you didn't believe hard enough. When you get these doubts and say, "Oh, I can't shift, I don't even know if it's real anymore at this point," try and ask yourself after, "But what if it's real? What if I can shift? You want to find out, do you?" I get it. Harry Potter is a cool world. That's why they made a whole theme park about it. Who wouldn't want to drop out of a Muggle public school and live in a castle with a bunch of soft British boys? And also magic or whatever. But you need to be mindful about where you're getting your information. I've watched hours of flat earthers and anti-vaxxers talk about their beliefs, and these people get their information from non-credible sources, and they end up pushing more fake information online, and it creates this echo chamber that warps their worldview. I don't want kids watching these TikToks or going on Amino and essentially get lied to and think this is how the world works. I'm hoping that all of these people will look back at themselves in 10 years and go, "Yeesh, I can't believe I was so obsessed about a thing, I literally tried to astral project myself across the multiverse. Right, Bakugo?" I know that this reality can suck sometimes, and right now it's looking pretty bad. But like it or not, this is the one reality we get. A lot of things may be out of your control, but according to theoretical physics, we make a lot of choices. And all our choices lead us down different paths. So what you need to do is not give up on this reality for a literal fictitious one, but instead to make choices that will make this current reality your desired reality. Thank you all for coming to my TED Talk.
Uncle James, can we play Space Explorer?
Shut up for a second. I'm watching this unnaturally charming preschool show.
Why are you watching a show for babies?
Okay, kid. This show is extremely sophisticated and can be enjoyed by both children and adults. So why don't you shut your ignorant mouth and find someone who actually loves you to play your silly little space game?
Crikey, Bingo! You can't say that to your sister! You have to say nice things! Treat others how you want to be treated, mate!
Oh, I really needed to hear that today. This episode of The Odd Ones Out is called... Are you familiar with the Australian animated preschool show Bluey?
If your TikTok algorithm is anything like mine, you'll have seen a bunch of clips of this blue cartoon dog all over your For You page, paired with Subway Surfer highlights. Wow, TikTok, clips of a foreign preschool show? I thought you were supposed to cater to my interests. Let's read some of the comments on these bluey TikToks, shall we? No shame, I'm a senior in high school, but I watch Bluey religiously, and this episode had me all in my feels. I'd say I had a good childhood, but I binge Bluey because adult life is so stressful and I'm sad, and it reminds me of a simpler time. Bluey is for everyone. I'm literally 27, and it's such a comfort show.
Bluey is absolutely destroying me as a teenager who wishes he had this childhood.
In my teen years and watching full episodes of Bluey.
Watching Bluey high is such a fun time, dude.
Huh. You know, to me, I'm just thinking out loud here. It seems like a lot of these comments weren't made by preschoolers. What's going on here? Now, if your brain is anything like mine, you'll be thinking, why is this show about Australian dogs so popular with adults who don't even have children? In fact, why does Bluey have over 5 billion views on TikTok, is searched more than Paw Patrol, Peppa Pig, and Coco Melon, and why is this episode number 8 in IMDb's highest rated episodes of all time? This phenomenon intrigued me, and I was also bullied by a large number of people on my own team to watch the show. So, one day I sat down, put on the first episode, and
I watched all 141 episodes.
Hang on, James! 141? But there's only 129 on Disney Plus! Don't worry, my fellow obsessive Bluey fan, we're gonna talk about that later. I work in cartoons, and I've been to furry conventions, so Bluey has always been on my radar of shows I'm aware of. And just from the clips that I saw, I adored the art style, especially the backgrounds. So much so that my very own background team has studied and taken inspiration from Bluey's backgrounds. Here you can see my backgrounds taking on a more Bluey aesthetic. I mean, just look at the colors, especially their greens. Oh my god! Doesn't just looking at these backgrounds bring a smile to your face? While I was watching the first season, I realized, oh, okay, I see why this show is so popular. Because it's genuinely a good show. We've already established that the show is great to look at, but the voice acting, the sound design, and the music are equally as amazing, so it's also great to listen to. While most, if not all, other preschool shows will hire adults who can sound like toddlers, Bluey gets actual children to voice the actual child characters. Somehow, every Australian toddler in Bluey can be so expressive and emotional. It's impressive that the show got such a talented cast of child actors who don't sound annoying to listen to. Or maybe it's just their Aussie accents that I like, I don't know. The characters have so much personality, and the comedic timing is something I've never seen before in a preschool show. I can't think of a single time Coco Melon has made me laugh this much, or even smile. The four main characters are Chili and Bandit, the parents, and Bluey and Bingo, the 6 and 4-year-old daughters. Yes, Bluey is a girl. You gotta catch up, dude. Come on, it's 2023. The show also does not hide the fact that it's Australian. It references multiple Australian locations and animals, they call flip-flops thongs, and they say things like, "Honor!" While some preschool shows focus on teaching kids numbers and letters, Bluey focuses on the relationship of the family and teaches its lessons through the make-pretend games that the family plays. And I want to emphasize how perfect these two parents are. These two are the most patient and emotionally aware parents I've seen ever. There are multiple times where the parents apologize to their kids for, frankly, not even doing anything wrong. The dad is like the most perfect dad role model, okay? Check this out. Bingo was sad that dad didn't get to see the leaf bug outside. She was like,
"Daddy, come and see. Come here, Daddy. Quickly."
But he was too busy playing with Bluey, you know, being a present father figure in her life. And at night, she's all boo-hoo about it, and he kneels down, gets to her level, and apologizes, explaining that he didn't hear her. Now, I don't have any kids, but if I spent my weekend running around with toddlers, and then right before bed, one of them said, "You didn't get to see the ladybug," I would say, "That's okay. I've already seen a ladybug. Good night." In one episode, Chicken Rat, Bingo lost her favorite toy, and Mom asks, "Well, where was the last place you had it?" The two retrace Bingo's steps, and through flashbacks, we see this bizarre day that Bluey and Bingo had.
The very first flashback we see, Bluey and Bingo are cooking a chicken rat egg while wearing weird costumes. And through this creative backward storytelling, we piece together what a chicken rat is and how the kids ended up in this situation. It's episodes like that which really make me appreciate the care that went into the show, and really sets Bluey apart from every other preschool show. Most preschool shows stick to a formula and talk down to the viewer, because typically their viewers are short. As a childless adult, I don't want to say, this show teaches you how to be a good parent, because I don't know how to be a good parent. But on paper, there are lessons in this show that are just as important for the parents to learn. So while watching season one, I got a feel for the world and characters. I started to piece together, okay, this show is depicting perfect parents, it's well written and wholesome, anyone regardless of having kids can enjoy the show. Let's watch the rest, shall we? Season 2 and Season 3 is when things go from 100 to 1,000. This is when episodes cover deep and emotional topics that I think toddlers are too baby to understand. Let's see, there's the struggles of keeping romance in your relationship alive when you have two toddlers to look after, why taking time to play with your kids can have a ripple effect that lasts into adulthood, feeling inadequate as a mom, what it's like having a dad in the army, parents disagreeing on different parenting styles, moms getting tipsy implied, dealing with infertility, abandonment, potentially a miscarriage, that one's still up in the air, and death. Actually, that one was in season one. You can't even compare Bluey to other preschool shows. Like, what the fuck was Dora the Explorer even doing? Was she even trying to entertain the adults who are also going to be watching her show? Dora had the same formula every episode, and there was a map who sang a song that was just repeating the same three words 14 times. Season 2, there's an episode where Chili is telling Bluey about how when she was a baby, she wasn't crawling or rolling over as fast as the other babies in her mom group, and she compared Bluey's developmental delay to the other babies and felt inadequate as a mother. And then this pink poodle comes to console her, looks directly into the camera, and says, "You're doing great." I'm a he-him male with no kids, and I still get teary-eyed just thinking about that episode. People will tell you that Bluey is a kid's show that adults can enjoy too. No, that episode wasn't for the kids. It was directed at all the moms watching who are doubting their motherhood. When has Cocomelon ever done something like this? All the babies stop singing mid-nursery rhyme, look directly into the camera and say, "Hey mom, just wanted to say you're doing a great job raising me. Keep up the good work." Like, no, that'll never happen. I'm still not done talking about how impressive the writing in Bluey is, okay? So please indulge me for a bit. I'm switching into video essay mode as we do a deep dive into the themes and symbolisms of one of my favorite Bluey episodes, Flatpak. The entire episode is an allegory of human history told from a religious and scientific perspective, respectively. And it touches on the ever-growing relationships between a mother and child, all within 7 minutes. No, I'm not reading too deep into this. Let's begin. Bandit and Chili set out to build a new swing for their porch. And we get this great meta self-aware joke from Bandit when he complains about the instructions saying, I'm not taking advice from a cartoon dog. Meanwhile, the girls play games with the leftover packing materials that are thrown into the yard by their parents. Bluey and Bingo are given bubble wrap, which they pretend is water, so they pretend they're fish. Then they're given cardboard, which they pretend is land, so they pretend they're frogs. Then they're given tails and become lizards, then T-Rexes, then birds, then furry little animals. Is this chart starting to look familiar? Then they're monkeys, and then bipedal cave dogs. What? Is that you, Mr. Darwin? Were these girls playing out the evolution of man through a silly game? Now, if you didn't like the evolution symbolism, I know you're going to love the parents being an allegory for the creators. You know, the big guy upstairs, the whatever you believe is going on. The parents supply the girls with their entire world. They give the girls the sea, the land, the volcanoes, and the trees. In these cave paintings the girls make that tell their history, they depict the parents as gods, higher up and in the clouds. They do look a little angry. Perhaps they're still in the Old Testament. The parents being the creators is hinted at again by Chili when she looks at the girls lovingly saying, "Aww, we made them. The parents give the girls an Allen wrench, aka tools, and one industrial revolution later, the girls evolve from cave dogs to modern dogs, building futuristic towns and spaceships.
Throughout the episode, as the girls go through different stages of evolution, they also go through different stages of their lives as a mother and child. As fish, Bluey says that she's the mommy fish and Bingo is the baby. Then as frogs, Bingo pretends to be a toddler and Bluey teaches her how to catch flies. Then as T-Rexes, Bingo becomes a big girl. Then as cave dogs, she's a teenager. And finally, in the last stage, she's all grown up, ready to traverse the universe on her own. She thanks Bluey for looking after her and leaves on her spaceship. Bluey, now much older as shown by her having to use a cane, crosses the styrofoam threshold which represents her death and she gets to live with her creators. All while this orchestral masterpiece is playing and suddenly you realize you're crying? When did that start? And then Bandit ties the allegory all together at the very end saying, "Ah, this is heaven." Are you joshing me right now? This preschool show was able to tell a clever allegorical story with tasteful religious undertones in how many minutes? Did you just make me feel emotions over a cartoon dog? This isn't the only episode you can make an in-depth video essay on. There are plenty of other episodes that hit just as hard as this one. While I was doing research for this video, it got me thinking about another foreign animated kid show with 8-minute long episodes that focus on a family of two toddlers. Except, unlike Bluey, this show is universally hated. Caillou, it's Caillou. I had this idea in my head that people only hated Caillou because he was a more accurate portrayal of a toddler. But in the handful of Caillou episodes I watched, I was reminded, oh no, that's why people hate Caillou. Because he sucks! His brattiness isn't even important to the plot, it comes out of nowhere. Caillou will be getting ready in the morning, he spills cat food and says, "Gilbert, look what you did!" He's at the beach and this bird who's done nothing wrong gets told to go away! And there's a bunch more examples of Caillou being a whiny piece of shit. And I can't help but think that Caillou's screeching, piercing, whiny voice does not help him be a likable character. I bet real toddlers can be little punk sometimes, but why would you show that in your cartoon and not have him learn any lesson? There's never a lesson learned in Caillou. Since Caillou was a brat all the time, a lot of people, myself included, wondered why Caillou's parents never disciplined or even tried to change his bratty behavior. But after I thought about it, I realized it would be a very weird episode of Caillou if one day Caillou's mom was like, "Caillou, what did you do to your sister?" "I made her look pretty, Mommy." "Caillou, that was Mommy's expensive makeup. How many times do I have to tell you not to touch Mommy's things? Come here, you little twit."
"Mommy, why are you hitting?"
"Getting a spanking."
"Mommy, you're hurting
me." "I've had enough of you, Caillou. I hate you."
That kid got what was coming to him. I don't know, maybe that episode would be cathartic to some parents. Anyways, getting back to the actual best children's show ever, even though Bluey is literally the most mentally intelligent and educational show for the minds of children, teens, adults, and parents, some unnamed mouse company decided to censor some of the episodes on their platform. It's the strangest things that got censored, too. This horse pooping, Bandit getting hit in the groin, Bandit saying the word groin, this hitchhiker is no longer from Argentina, that one's kinda weird, this pretend cat saying it will pretend pee on the curtains, Bandit hinting at wanting to get snip snip down there. Adults, you know what I'm talking about. And the last 10 episodes of season 3, which are some of the deepest episodes in the series, aren't even on Disney Plus. But that could just be a licensing thing, I don't know. I kept waiting for the infertility episode. I heard so much about it. I finally got to the last episode on Disney Plus and thought, oh, okay, they're saving the deepest one for last. Alright, let's do this. And the episode was about the family playing courtroom to determine if Bandit farted. I hope this video convinced you to give Bluey a chance. I mean, you're still here listening to a grown man talk about it, so you gotta be at least a little interested in it. Through its relatable and realistic portrayal of family life, the show has not only entertained, but also taught valuable life lessons to its viewers. The show's emphasis on play and family bonding is so refreshing to see compared to the usual fast-paced, mind-numbing shows aimed at kids. Bluey reminds us all the importance of spending time with loved ones and finding joy in the everyday. And if you still don't want to watch Bluey, have you thought about getting high and watching it?
Thank you all so much for watching this episode of James getting obsessed over something he probably shouldn't be. Did you have a favorite part about this episode? Yeah, that was my favorite part too. Just one quick announcement. My newest Oddballs book is available on my website right now, so if you enjoyed the show, be sure to head over and reserve your copy today. It'll be full of new stories and illustrations and will be released on September 6th, and I'm super excited to hear what you all think of it. Anyway, thanks again for watching. Big shout out to my amazing team. They really crushed it this video, and you better be wearing your seatbelts.
Guys, I have a brilliant idea. What if we do the In My Feelings Challenge? What do you think?
What's the In My Feelings Challenge?
It was that dance people did outside of their moving cars in 2018.
That's stupid.
I know!
It's weird to me that YouTube Rewind 2018 came out over 5 years ago, which makes it old enough to be something to reminisce about. There's a fresh generation of iPad kids who don't get to experience the yearly tradition of coming together as a community and watching the newest YouTube Rewind. And absolutely hating it. In case you all forgot, the website YouTube.com used to make these celebratory videos showcasing all the important events and memes that had happened throughout the year. And all these YouTubers would get together and do a silly little dance and everyone had a grand old time. And since these videos were produced by the very platform you're currently watching this on, Rewinds would always receive a lot of attention. Now, according to my memory, YouTube Rewinds were pretty well received. At first. But you see, as time went on, the general public and the YouTubers involved started to grow weary. People were throwing around words like cringe, and this isn't what YouTube represents, and that's that. And it all accumulated to YouTube's magnum opus, YouTube Rewind 2018. Everyone controls Rewind. Hashtag YouTube Rewind. Which is a video that was so universally hated that it holds the world record for most disliked video ever. A record it will now hold perpetually because of the whole dislike thing. The audience wasn't happy, the YouTubers involved weren't happy, until finally YouTube snapped and was like, "Alright, fine, if no one wants it, we'll stop doing it! We were just doing this as a favor anyways!" And so YouTube discontinued the Rewind project indefinitely, with 2018 being the last time we ever got a Rewind.
What about me, James?
How dare you even consider yourself worthy of being called a Rewind 2019?
A top 10 video? Really? At least 2011 had Rebecca Black hosting.
Leave 2019 before I tell you the top 10 ways on how I'm gonna hurt you!
So getting back to the actual last YouTube Rewind, you know, the one with the most dislikes in the whole world, if we skip to 3 minutes and 2 seconds into that video, we see...
Guys, let's do the In My Feelings Challenge!
Oh, geez. That's me.
I know I'm a little late to the party, but since we've all had enough time to grow and reflect as people, I would like to finally share some of my thoughts and experiences working on YouTube Rewind 2018. The first thing I want to talk about is how none of the YouTubers involved got any type of monetary compensation. At least none of the ones I talked to did. This was a big issue that a lot of other YouTubers had in their expose videos, but I personally was not bothered by it. Was I getting paid in exposure? Yes. In fact, I actually lost money doing this because I had to get my friend Rush to animate some of the scenes, so I, you know, paid him for his work. But what I'm trying to tell you is that as much as I'm about to complain about YouTube Rewind, don't feel any sort of empathy for me, okay? I did this to myself. I think the best piece of advice I could give you is that if YouTube ever reaches out to you and is like, "Hey, do you want to be a part of Rewind?" you should say, "Let me read the script first." But I didn't know that in 2018, and I also didn't know that in 2017. If you look at YouTube Rewind 2017 and watch all the way to the end, keep going... Right there in the credits is me and Jaden doing a floss in space. It was a lot cooler back then. They also wanted all the animators to animate our characters in the middle of a jello fight, and I think they wanted to put our cartoon characters over footage of real-life YouTubers in the middle of a jello fight, but they gave us no direction, and I don't think they ever filmed a scene where they were like, okay, real-life YouTubers, remember to leave that spot empty because that's where the animated guy's gonna go. Because, you know, they gotta plan that kind of stuff out ahead of time, right? So instead, they just threw our unusable animated jello fight with no background at the very end as this extremely out-of-place post-credits scene. So 2017 was pretty uneventful for me. Like, yeah, I was in YouTube Rewind, but, you know, I was in the credits. Who's going to stick around and watch the credits, you know? But 2018 was going to be my year. Rewind wanted me back, and this time they were giving me a speaking role. Holy shit. My line was going to be, guys, let's do the In My Feelings challenge. And then the YouTuber Swoozy, who would be in his real-life human form, would say, right? And then we'd fist bump Who Framed Roger Rabbit style. So do you remember that trend in 2018 where people were doing that dance outside of their moving car? Well, apparently, that was called the In My Feelings challenge. Back in 2018, I didn't even know it was called that. I thought it was called stupid. Now, if you've at all watched YouTube Rewind 2018, Everyone Controls Rewind, hashtag YouTube Rewind, you might be wondering why after I specifically suggest we do the In My Feelings challenge, that not a single YouTuber or talk show host can be seen dancing outside of a moving vehicle. That's because YouTube didn't want to promote unsafe behavior. So they didn't want to show anyone dancing outside of a car. So they weren't really doing the challenge then, were they? YouTube, if you don't want to promote unsafe behavior, don't promote the In My Fucking Feelings challenge. Kids are still going to look up the In My Feelings challenge and then watch multiple videos of people dancing outside of cars on YouTube.
We don't want to promote unsafe behavior.
It's on your platform, dog. You know, looking back, that should have been my first red flag, but I was still optimistic. I was so excited to be a part of this huge project, and I knew there were going to be a bunch of YouTubers involved, but I was going to be one of the few animated ones. I was going to stand out. I was going to be the odd one out. Knowing how Rewind handled animation in 2017, when they asked me to be a part of 2018, I told them, hey, love the line, but I think it would be a good idea if we met in person, you know, and that way you can show me everything you're planning, and I can ask you all the right questions. And they agreed and invited me to visit the set the day they were filming Swoozy's line. So I was there, physically behind the camera, when Swoozy said, right? And then fist bumped nothing. I got to experience what it was like to be on a real film set with actors and directors and costumes and catering and makeup, and it was a lot, honestly, for just one line. And maybe it was because they had booked Swoozy for a full hour, but they had this beautiful man say, right? And then fist bump nothing no less than 50 times. It's one line, guys. I think we got it. And then after, like, take 87, my stomach sank when the director said, okay, Swoozy, how about you try saying, guys, let's do the In My Feelings challenge? Wait a minute. That's my line. Are we changing it? Which line am I animating now? Do you want me to do both, just like how you got Swoozy to do both? And what? Oh, you'll pick your favorites? I asked the director right there which line was I animating, and he said he was going to let me know. And then we went outside and filmed Swoozy dance in front of a brick wall, and which parts of him dancing was I going to animate my guy next to? He said he was going to let me know that too. So I took all the information I learned that day and referred it back to the other animators. What they wanted were two shots. They wanted 5 seconds of our characters dancing, and they wanted another shot of all of us sitting around a campfire singing horribly. After doing some quick math, I realized that if all 7 of us animators did a 5-second dance, that would be 35 seconds of cartoons dancing, which for a YouTube Rewind would be a lot of screen time. I had a sinking feeling that they weren't going to be using our full 5-second clips, and they didn't even let me know. Now, for my life-changing speaking role, I had to record my line on my own, which normally wouldn't be a problem. But in late 2018, I had just moved to California, and I didn't have my own setup set up. And to make the whole situation worse, I was only given 1 week to finish my animation and record my line. So, you know, the clock was ticking. Now, I think the second best piece of advice I could give you is that if you're ever in need of a quick jerry-rigged sound booth, go into your closet and hide under a comforter. In fact,
hello, real-life human James here, coming to you on a Blue Yeti inside of a bathroom. The acoustics in here are terrible. Could you imagine voicing a cartoon character in this? Guys, let's do the In My Feelings challenge. See, it doesn't work. Now.
All right, and now we're here inside of our makeshift sound booth, and you can hopefully hear the quality change right away, you know, like, guys, let's do the In My Feelings challenge. See, you know, we don't need expensive sound booths to have a good time. But back in 2018, I wanted the most important line in my career to be recorded in a professional sound booth. Luckily, I was in luck. You see, California is one of the few places home to something called a YouTube space. A YouTube space advertises itself as a place to aid content creators, providing them with facilities to create content for their YouTube channels. And to access said facilities, you needed at least 10,000 subscribers. A little weird they put a number on it, but I get it. I had just moved to California. I knew I was going to be hitting this place up all the time. When I first went to the YouTube space, I didn't call ahead or set up an appointment or anything because there wasn't an option to do so on the website. But I figured they would have to help me out, right? The line I needed to record was for a YouTube Rewind. And you're a YouTube space! Like, Susan personally asked me to be here, you know? So I drove an hour to the space, I went inside, showed them my sub count, and they said that in order to use the facilities, I had to fill out all these forms on my computer back home. But it's for YouTube Rewind. Then I drove another hour back home and started filling out the forms, but by the time I got to the quizzes, I realized, huh, I think this wild goose chase is probably going to take longer than a week to resolve. With time running out, I gingerly asked my new friend Aaron if I could use his setup, and he said yes, and I didn't even have to show him my sub count. I mean, I showed him anyway, though. So the line you hear me say in the 2018 Rewind was recorded in the Game Grumps office, which I think means, at the very least, Game Grumps deserves to be credited in the description of Rewind. Come on, YouTube! They were the only ones who took me in when your own company turned me away! The deadline was fast approaching. I mean, it was fast approaching as soon as I got it, but I've been in crunch mode before, and I'm sure the nameless video editors were just trying to hit their impossibly tight deadlines too. I reminded myself what I was making all of these sacrifices for. Everyone was going to unanimously love this video and what it represents and look up my channel afterwards and subscribe. December 6th, 2018. A day that changed history. It was raining that day, and the world was exposed to what YouTube had been cooking up. And they all collectively hated it. Like, a lot. Like, to the point where I would be lucky if I didn't lose subscribers. I think the audience knew that none of the YouTubers involved had any say in the creative process. We were just reading our lines from YouTube script, you know? So at least I get to say I'm in the most disliked video in history, and no one's too mad at me. Right? So was all of this stress worth it? Now, I got paid in exposure, and the exposure was overwhelmingly negative. In fact, I think Rewind was only positive for one other YouTuber. Do you have any guesses? Jaden motherfucking Animations pulled off the biggest prank of 2018. One of the reasons people disliked 2018's Rewind was because PewDiePie, the number one YouTuber at the time, wasn't included. But Jaden, being the genius that she is, knew he wasn't going to be included again, so she snuck in a PewDiePie reference into her 5-second dance, and no one caught it, and it made the final cut. Jaden was crowned the least cringy part of Rewind, and everyone loved her, and she got a big boost in subscribers, and all I gotta say to that is, good job, Jaden. How are you enjoying that cake and eating it, too? Now, there are a lot of valid reasons why people dislike 2018's Rewind. One of them being that the video starts out with Will Smith? He's not a YouTuber. But they didn't seem to mind when 2016 started out with The Rock and 2017 started with The Colbert Show. But whatever.
And I don't know if you remember what YouTube was like in 2018, but it was in the news a couple of times, you know, over a few small things. However, with all of that being said, I do genuinely miss YouTube Rewinds. Getting to wake up and go, wow, it's December and a new YouTube Rewind just dropped. I'm going to watch it. And then I get to see a handful of YouTubers I recognize do a dance and not recognize any of the other YouTubers. And then I get to see the rest of the internet's reaction to it. It's better than Christmas for me. Even if it's the cringiest video ever, we still all watched it together as a community. And I think that's what I miss the most, when YouTube felt more like a community. As long as it's not a top 10 video, I welcome back YouTube Rewinds with open arms. And if they do make a comeback, I don't think I'd want to be a part of them. Not because I got burned in 2018, but because I wouldn't want to rob another ignorant YouTuber of the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be taken advantage of and work for free and be a part of history. For now, we just have to live with the 9 rewinds we do have. But if you're like me and are just dying to see more YouTube Rewind content, and I know you are because you're still here, I've discovered a pretty massive Easter egg. In the description of Rewind 2018 is a link to See All the Easter Eggs. And for your viewing pleasure are 13 brand new shorts that I can only describe as skits that were edited together with existing Rewind footage. I don't think that's what an Easter egg is. They're not that funny and are pretty hard to watch, but isn't that what Rewind's all about? Have a good night.
Kiki, do you love me? Are you riding? Don't you ever say, because I want you.
And I want you.
And I want you.
And I want you.
Don't you ever hey.
Oh, that's
that. I don't know the rest of the words.
Oh, that's that.
All right, I think we got it.
The very first comic I drew was this fan-made Garfield comic that I did when I was like 9. This was the Garfield comic that came out when I was born. Okay, back to Twilight.
Hello?
James, we found it.
What? What did you find?
The Garfield comic, man.
So remember how I said the first comic I made was a Garfield comic? Of course you remember. I just showed you a clip of it. So apparently my mom kept it. That just amazes me. I need to call her. Hold on.
Hello?
Hey, Mom. I just want to say that you have a hoarding problem. Like, seriously, you need to throw some stuff away once in a while. Okay, bye. Man, I love her. Did you know the creator of Garfield, Jim Davis, is 70 freaking years old? And he's still making Garfield? How do you even... And he's made 14,000 comics? Oh, he has co-artists and he doesn't even draw them anymore. Well, I just lost a bit of respect for my hero. If you guys wanted to start reading Garfield, you have a lot of catching up to do. So you know I love Garfield. It was a big inspiration to me. So much so that the very first comic I ever made was about Garfield. And I know in the video I said that I made it when I was like 9. But looking back at this, I want to say that I was like 6 months old. It's that bad. So, everyone shut up, and without further ado, this is the very first comic I made. Okay, let me explain some stuff. Let's go over this panel by panel. See how there's a graphic in this corner here? Well, Jim would make a unique graphic on every Sunday comic. So this is a Sunday comic, everyone. That means it's in color. Orange is a color. So the first panel, there's Odie, Garfield, and John. And John is saying, "Happy birthday! It's Garfield's birthday." And they're about to eat this physically impossible-looking cake. So there's this running joke in the Garfield comic that Garfield hates his birthday because he's getting way older. He's in his late 30s now! Jeez! So keep that in mind, because in the next panel... Wah! You might not be able to tell from the comic, but that's the sound of a fire truck pulling up. Because in panel number 3, there's firefighters saying, "Where's the fire?" And you know they're firefighters because this guy's holding a fire hose. That's a hose, okay? I was 6, you perverts! I just want to point out that I spelled fire like how it should be spelled. F-I-R. Really, this is the wrong way if you think about it. Fiery. In case you didn't get the joke, there's so many candles on Garfield's cake that it was enough to warrant a visit from the firemen, because Garfield is so old and he just has a bunch of candles on his cake. And then in the next panel, John explains to the fireman that there was nothing to worry about. My cat just having a B-day. Garfield's still confused, though. And then in the next panel, the cake is falling apart as we speak, and we hear another sound effect. It's beep, beep. Now, if we follow the speech bubble, we can clearly see that the sound is coming from the ceiling. John already knows what's happening because he says,
Oh, no. And then in a brand new color, blue, it starts raining on them. It was the sprinkler from above. John runs away going, ah! You know, something similar happened with sprinklers in the Incredibles movie. Oh shoot, I gotta call it The Incredibles 1 in case you're watching this after June 2019. So if I got inspiration from The Incredibles 1, which came out in 2004, that would mean I would be a minimum of 8 years old. So maybe I did make this comic when I was 9. That is, I'm assuming I stole that joke from The Incredibles movie, which I wouldn't put past myself. Alright guys, what if I told you there was a second Garfield comic that I made? I'm a little hesitant to show you because, I don't know what's going on in this one. So let's look at it and see if we can figure it out together. So it starts with a Garfield graphic. It's another Sunday comic. It doesn't seem as excited as the other one, though. Then in panel one, we see... what is that? I think that's a toothbrush and that's toothpaste. And it says Teth on it. Okay, panel two. John walks up to said Teth brush and Teth paste. And then he says, they say you should use to pee big toothpaste. I was in honor classes, you know. Then it looks like he's about to brush his teeth with a massive teeth brush. And then, Garfield, that's not pee, sis. And then, I don't even know. I don't know what that is. And then, there's two? And one's green? And then we see Garfield say, yes, it is. So, like I said, I don't know what this one's about. I don't know what the joke is. I just don't get it. So I will make you an offer. I will give $20 to anyone that explains what this comic is trying to do. Actually, let's make it a prime $23. So $23 to anyone who can decipher this. I will be taking your guesses on Twitter and in the YouTube comments, and I will give out the $23 to whichever explanation I think explains the comic the best. So not necessarily the first person to get it will get the $23, just whichever one I see first.
Mommy, why do humans hate us?
I don't know, Matthew. Our species is completely harmless to them, and we keep the mosquito population down, who are responsible for killing more humans every year than other humans do.
So, humans have no rational reason to fear us, but they still do?
I'm afraid humans aren't that smart, Matthew. Sleep tight. Don't let the bed humans bite.
Love you, Mommy.
I love you too, Matthew.
Mom?
I think the hate that spiders get is a tad bit undeserved. Okay, fine, if you're in the shower and you see a spider crawling up your leg like a freaking pervert, then that's an appropriate time to freak out. But other than that, spiders are most likely not going to hurt you. Their webs are too weak to trap you, they don't know how to open doors, and there's only like a 50% chance that they're venomous. Okay, but for real, unless you live in Australia, the chances of you dying by a spider bite is pretty low. There are venomous spiders, yes, and if you're having a negative reaction to a spider bite, then you should get treatment, but a large percentage of spiders are harmless. Even the Black Widow, known as the most venomous spider in North America, won't kill you if you're a healthy adult. Their bite will be painful for a couple of days, sure, but like, you'll walk it off.
That was a joke. If you get bitten by a Black Widow spider, then don't walk it off. Go see a doctor.
And hey, if you're lucky enough, you'll get superpowers. So, wait, the two most dangerous spiders in North America are the brown recluse and the Black Widow? What are you trying to say about dangerous colors, America? Oh wait, the great white shark's even more dangerous. Never mind. Technically, sharks are like the second least dangerous animal out there besides puppies, because like they don't want to eat humans. I mean, like if you had to fight a spider and a shark, this shark would win. Also, spiders kill pests. According to this comic I made in 2014 and this National Geographic article, a single spider can eat about 2,000 insects a year. So if you're not a fan of flies, moths, or mosquitoes, which incidentally kill 600,000 people a year, then you're on Team Spider, because they're also not fans of them. Well, they are fans of them, but they are fans because they eat them. I'm not saying you have to be roommates with arachnids. I'm just saying that if you see a spider, don't put it through torture continuously smashing it with a blunt object. It's still moving! It's still moving!
Kill me.
Instead, get a cup and carefully place it over a spider. They're really dumb, so doing this will be super easy. Then scoop up your new best friend with a piece of paper and yeet it back into the wild with the rest of God's glorious creatures. Yeah, actually, there's a high chance that they won't make it being thrown into a completely different environment, but they should have thought of that before they decided to live in my house. Even though a spider has 8 eyes, they have terrible eyesight. So that spider that landed on your face did not do it intentionally. Some spiders that live in caves are completely blind. They don't even have 1 eye. But even if they did have eyes, their whole world would still be pitch black. What a sad life to be a part of. Just every time you're outside seeing the sun, just think that somewhere there's a colony of spiders just in pure blackness. Just never seeing the sun, never seeing their children smile or graduate college. They're just sitting in a cave for all their life. So is nature, and that is the way the cookie crumbles. Also, we're forgetting the most amazing thing about spiders, which is that they're incredibly talented in web design. Proportionately, the silk that makes up a spider web is stronger than the fibers that make up a bulletproof vest. So next time you go to a gunfight, put on a spider web instead. The amazing thing about spider webs is that not only can they save Wilbur from being slaughtered, but it's just stupid incredible that something so small can make such an intricate shape from nothing but the material inside their own bodies. The golden silk orb weaver spider has too many middle names and has enough silk inside of them to make 3 full spider webs. And it's this guy's job to pin that spider down and pull out all of its silk like some kind of spider predator. It's okay though, the documentary said he was just harmlessly immobilizing the spiders. I can't believe this is someone's job. I don't think telling people I'm a YouTuber is that bad anymore. So, what do you do for a living? I harmlessly immobilize spiders with thumbtacks and pull silk out of their abdomen to add to my ever-increasing collection. What about you? Oh, I, make YouTube videos? I see people with arachnophobia being irrationally afraid of these harmless little guys, and I just don't see the sense of fearing something that ultimately does good things for the ecosystem. But you know what we should be afraid of? Bees! Bees are terrifying! Look, they're sucking the blood out of this guy to make honey! Oh, they're dying at an alarming rate? Good! Okay, that was a joke. Bees are, without a doubt, the most important insect on this planet. Not only do they have the best work ethic of any living thing on Earth, which is why none of them are YouTubers, they also pollinate 30% of the world's crops. Don't ask me who pollinates the rest, because I don't know. Without bees, humanity would turn to pure anarchy. Bees are so important that world-famous comedian Jerry Seinfeld made a documentary about the life of a bee and what the world would be like without them. But ever since 2006, bees, just like all the memes say, have been dying at an alarming rate. The scary thing is that scientists don't know exactly the reason for this bee-pocalypse. But they think it has to do with new pesticides being used on farms, parasites that kill the bee, and global warming. So once we figure out how to fix those 3 problems, we'll be in good shape. It's a little bee pun. We like to have fun around here. Now, what can you, a concerned citizen, do to stop the dropping population of bees? Most likely nothing, because I don't think anyone watching this makes laws about pesticides or stopping global warming. So we just gotta sit back and hope the people who make those laws know the importance of bees. But maybe you should plant a couple flowers just to be on the safe side. The reason I have a fear of bees is that I've gotten stung by a bee not 3 times, not 4 times, but 2 times! Two times! Now, obviously, as I've grown, I see the importance of bees, and I know not to throw rocks at them. The first time I got stung, I was outside, and I guess I was playing too close to a beehive, because I got stung on my arm, and I cried a lot. The second time, I was in my backyard, barefoot, and I was walking around, and you know how sometimes when you're about to do something, and your brain realizes that you're about to make a mistake, but your body is already committed to the motion, and you don't have enough time to stop yourself? So I was in the middle of taking a step, and I saw that I was about to step on a bee, but my body didn't have the reaction time or the motor skills to avoid the step, and... I'm sure the bee was just acting in self-defense, but... Man, that scarred me. Some people may have an allergic reaction to bee stings, and they should go to a hospital if they get stung, but in my case, it just hurt a lot, and my mom put baking soda over where I got stung, and I cried. When people found out I was afraid of bees, they would always tell me that bees are docile creatures, and they only sting you if they feel threatened. They would say the same thing about spiders too, by the way. So whenever I would see a bee, I would silently freak out and stay as still as a rock, cause unlike spiders, with bees, you're not allowed to fight back. You'll both lose if that happens. I gotta show this bee how unthreatening I am. It should be able to just take a look at me and know that. But then, when a bee lands on your arm... Holy frick. That's true fear. You just have to quietly watch the bee, hoping it didn't just have a bad day and decide to end its life on you. That never happened, though. Ever since I took a more calm approach to bees, I've never been stung. And I've never been bitten by a spider, either. Wasps, though, they're just mean. They can pack up and leave for all I care. I don't give a crap about wasps. So, what did we learn?
Okay, so I'm just going to get right into the meat of this topic. I love reading fables. If you weren't paying attention in 10th grade English, a fable is a short story, usually with talking animals that have a moral at the end of them. A good way to remember is that the word fable starts with an F, and so does furry. So, some examples of a fable you might have heard are the tortoise and the hare, Humpty Dumpty, Pacific Rim, and the autobiography of Hillary Clinton. This one's a fable because the main character is a bit. I'm just kidding. Humpty Dumpty's not a fable. So there's this guy named Aesop, and he's best known for creating a bunch of fables. He's written over 655, and seriously, I don't know why for some reason we can't find the exact number. How many fables has he written? Over 655! Oh, so 656? Like, what's the range here? Unfortunately, he has died, so we won't be writing any more fables. So why can't we get the exact number? Like, what the heck, guys? And he also had a very strong no-photo policy, so no pictures of him were ever taken. Because he was born around 500 BC. I don't even think he knew what a camera was, so here we go. This is what he supposedly looked like. And what I like most about fables is that the wording is so, like, Shakespearean and old-timey, and it makes you feel like you're smart for reading these short paragraph-long stories. And even better, they have a moral at the end of them, so once you're done reading, you're like, oh man, that was deep. Like, every single fable can end with one character dropping a microphone. Like, the whole story is just build-up to that one moral moment. Okay, so I'm going to read some of my favorite fables to you guys. I'm not going to read them how Aesop wrote them, though, because he had so many unnecessary smart-sounding words when really all of his fables could be shortened down to, like, 3 sentences. So here we go. Aesop's fables in my own words.
Belling the cat.
So there's these mice that get together, and they're trying to come up with a plan to get this cat to stop killing them. And one mouse is like, oh, we could put a bell around the cat, you know? So now we could hear it or something. And this other mouse is like, yeah, alright, yeah, that's cool. Who's gonna put the bell on? Okay, so this one's kind of actually stupid. I don't really know what the moral is. Like, maybe no one wants to be the person to sacrifice themselves for the good of humanity or my sanity or... Okay, here's my version of the rest of that story. So after the mouse said that, the other mouse goes, oh, geez, other mouse, you're right. I didn't think of that. Well, I guess I say we all grab our toothpicks and kill the cat. You know, at least that ending made sense. A bell? Pfft. How about you poison it? Or, like, move somewhere where there's not a cat in the first place.
The horse and the groom.
So there's this horse and a groom, which is not the wedding kind. It's an actual groomer, who just calls himself a groom. So this groom spends all this time brushing the horse and making it look pretty. And he also takes some of the horse's oats and sells it for extra cash. Okay, stop right there. Aren't oats supposed to be really cheap? Isn't that a thing? Okay, so the horse is getting malnourished and says, you know, you should really stop worrying about brushing me and more about feeding me. Man, that's deep, I think. The moral is, don't steal your horse's oats. Especially if it talks, like you will never hear the end of it. The farmer with the goose with the golden eggs. So there's this farmer, and he somehow gets a goose that lays golden eggs. And now you might be thinking, what's with all these gooses that lay golden eggs? Jack and the Beanstalk did it. The Simpleton Brothers did it. Well, did you know that this is the very first time a goose laying golden eggs has ever appeared in writing? I actually don't know if that's true. I made it up. I mean, it might be true. I don't know. It was 500 BC, you guys. It was a long time ago. And the goose only lays one egg a day, and the farmer gets greedy and wants more eggs. So he thinks, oh, I bet all the eggs are inside the goose. So he chops up the goose, and guess what? There's only more goose parts in there, not eggs. Okay, so the moral, know how basic things work, especially if you're a farmer and you don't know how geese work, or at least be close friends with someone who knows this. Hey man, I don't think that's how geese work. I mean, I get how you might think this is a magic goose because everything about this is physically impossible, but we could already live pretty decent lives with just one egg a day. Like, we're already in the top 1% now. How can a goose carry around a golden egg inside of itself? Do you know how heavy gold is? If there's solid gold, can a goose ever have babies? This seems like an evolutionary dead end to me. The bat and the weasels. So there once was this bat, and he fell. Somehow. Aesop never really says how it fell. It's a bat. It can fly. Okay, so the bat gets caught by a weasel. Like, one of these things? Okay, so you're saying that a bat gets caught by a weasel because he fell. Whatever, okay. So the weasel says, I am an enemy to all birds, and I'm going to eat you. And the bat goes, I'm not a bird, I'm a mouse. Oh, what are these things that look like wings? Oh, these, that's my blanket, because I'm cold. Okay, that part wasn't in the story. So the weasel lets him go, but then it happens again with a different weasel, and this weasel says, I am an enemy to mice, and I'm going to eat you. And the bat goes, oh, tiny weasel, but I'm not a mouse. I'm a bird. And then he lets him go. Again. Sometimes Aesop wrote the moral you're supposed to take at the end. He did it with this one, and the moral verbatim is, look and see which way the wind blows before you commit yourself. So are you saying to follow the crowd? Like, go with the flow? That's not really good moral, Aesop. Also, why didn't the bat just say, I'm a bat, losers, and I can fly later? It's also teaching you to make up lies on the spot that contradict your first lie. That's how you get caught lying. Okay, so last fable, the fox and the crow. So this crow has a piece of cheese in her beak, and this fox comes along and is like, oh, you're so beautiful. Oh, I just love your feathers. I wish I could just hear you sing. This crow is now very flattered, and she goes to sing, and then the cheese falls out of her mouth, and the fox eats it. And then the last line, this is beautiful, the fox says, you have a voice, madam, I see. What you want is wits. Moral of the story, everyone wants to steal your cheese. Don't let your guard down for a second. That would be a good t-shirt design. Like, it would say, everyone wants to steal your cheese, and then it would have like a silhouette of a fox and a crow. Someone make that t-shirt. I'll buy it.
Well, hey there, partner! Have you ever wondered where your favorite Odd Ones merch comes from? Well, head on down to Odd One's Family Farm and see where the merch comes to life. Here at Odd One's, we've got the largest merch fields in the country. We have a whole lot of things for you to enjoy. Over here, we've got pins and keychains growing by the bushel. We water them with fresh enamel every day so they stay nice and shiny. Look at the glimmer on that sucker.
Glimmery.
Or maybe you want to stop by our tree shirt orchard and see how we grow our t-shirts and hoodies. Softer than a marshmallow's bottom. We pick these fresh just before the holiday season. And if you buy one shirt, I'll throw in another one just because I like you. Oh, would you look at this? Our plushies are just about ready to harvest. Get ready to see one of nature's most amazing miracles. Oh, whoops, I guess they're not ripe yet. But wait, there's more! All of our posters and board games are printed from our Pedigree inkjet cows. How's your ink today, Bessie? You think you can print one more poster for us? Ah, now look at that shine! Be sure to stop by our petting zoo and bundle up in one of our fleece blankets during this cold winter season. And don't you worry, we remove the sheep carcass before we send you the blanket. Yes, sirree, we've got deals for everybody. Get them while they're hot. Come on, don't be shy. Hey there, little buddy. Are you lost? If you're searching for something really special, we've got that too. You're a lucky one, you know that? I don't usually let folks see what I'm cooking down here. Usually. I've got the peekaboo print shirt, cozy color print hoodies and long sleeve tees, freshly squeezed wave knit socks. Oh, those? Those are just Baby James drool beanies. Careful, they bite. Now this... this is the best, most cream-of-the-crop invention yet. Now all of my fans can have a little piece of me. And
I can be with them forever.
Help me.
Where are you going? Don't you want to stay for the deals?
Anyways, now that the harvest has begun, hurry on over to theoddones.com to find your perfect bundle before we sell out. Our new lab items include the Doodles Hoodie, Baby James Beanie, a bunch of new shirts, arcade blanket, colorway knit socks, and my personal favorite, the Odd Ones Out official lava lamp. This is also the chance to grab some Oddballs merch too. Grab your James, Max, and Josie plug today. And remember, don't go to any scary farms this holiday season. But if you do, be sure to film it. All right, that's all you're going to hear from me. Remember to wear your seatbelt.
Okay, class. Spell Wednesday. I don't know how to spell Wednesday. Well, James, just sound it out. Oh, okay. So, like this?
No, James, it's Wednesday.
You said sound it out, and that's how you sound it out.
Ha ha ha! You think you have it bad? Do is spelt with an X. Ha ha ha
ha! I think it comes to no surprise that I'm terrible at spelling. I feel like everyone in life falls into two categories. Either you're good at math and bad at reading, or you're weird. And if you've seen my other videos, you know that I'm a math boy. My mom told me that I have dyslexia because she has dyslexia and I have all the symptoms, but we never got that diagnosed by a doctor, so... You can't make me take my meds, Mom! A lot of times what I do to cover up the fact that I spell lower than a first grade level is I will purposely misspell words to the point where it's obviously a joke. You thought I was doing that to be funny, but it's actually because I have zero self-confidence in my spelling and I don't want anyone to point out my mistakes. I mentioned this in a different video, but in elementary school, I was put into an honors program and everyone had to take spelling tests a grade ahead of their level. And by everyone, I mean everyone except me, because I failed every single spelling test. So I had to take spelling tests that were on level. Ew. Every week when we took a spelling test, I would have to move to the back of the classroom, and the teacher would stand right next to me. She'd call out everyone else's word, which had like 8 syllables, like anti-disestablishmentarianism, and then she'd turn to me and give me my on-level word. James, your word is cat. Also, one year our class did a spelling bee, and everyone had to participate, and like, I didn't even care that I was the first one out. Hey, that's almost my name. Another thing that I mentioned in a pretty old video is that I used to have a speech impediment when I was little. I couldn't pronounce my Oz and I talked like this. I'm good now.
Obviously.
So every other day during school, I had to go to a speech therapy class, and one day the teacher who taught me how to pronounce my Oz, I'll call her Mrs. Kool-Aid, gave me this sheet of paper with a bunch of raindrops on it, and she said, "For every raindrop on this page, say the word raindrop." But then she just left the room, and I said, huh, well, I'm not going to do this. I didn't say Wayne drop a single time, because, like, no one was even there. No one would have seen me not saying Wayne drop. So why would I do something that I didn't want to do? But then the funny part is when she came back, she asked, "Are you finished saying your raindrops?" "No." "Well, how many did you say?" "I didn't say any."
You stupid child.
I told her the truth for some reason. I don't know why. It was probably the easiest lie in my life to get away with, but that's why I remember this story. I'm still mad at myself for telling the truth. And I had to say raindrop a bunch of times in front of her, and she would only go to the next raindrop until I said it right, and it was terrible. It really hurt my feelings. Since I was struggling with reading and spelling, I had to get an IEP. An incredible, excellent personality. Which meant I had to go to a special class for a little bit during school. And the teacher who taught this class was none other than Mrs. Kool-Aid.
Oh yeah.
I don't know why I said it like that. I don't remember anyone ever telling me I was put into a special needs class. I just remember going into speech therapy every other day. And then those classes slowly morphed into teaching me how to read and spell. I don't know, I thought reading this book would have helped me talk better. Two other kids were in the reading class with me, and I remember the day when reading for me just clicked. Us three were given a simple sentence to read. It was about bees. It was so simple. It was literally just, "To defend their hive from wasps, bees don't sting the wasp. Instead, they all crowd around the wasp and flap their wings to raise their body temperature, heating up the wasp until it dies." And then Mrs. Kool-Aid asked us, "Okay, how do bees defend against wasps?" And the other two kids said, "They sting them." And I said, "What? No, you moans! Didn't you weed this?" The words in this paper have meaning when placed in a certain order to convey information. Also, I never want to get hugged by a bee. So I was in these classes all the way until the sixth grade. I was getting better at reading. I still wasn't great, but I was getting better at it. And one day, Mrs. Kool-Aid said, "You know, James, you should try competing in the Battle of the Books." Battle of the Books? Battle of the Books?
Battle of the Books!
Finally, reading sounds fun! At my school, Battle of the Books was this competition where students were given a list of 4 books to read within a time limit of, like, 2 months. I don't remember how long it was. And after however many months it was, the contestants would sit in an auditorium and take turns answering questions about the books. And whoever got the most questions right would get a pizza party. And that's where the battle part comes in. We'd kill each other for pizza. And then there were 2 more rounds, each with 4 more books, so there was a total of 12 books you had to read. And we were allowed to be with a partner, so my partner was TJ. Hey, TJ, do you remember Battle of the Books?
Yeah, man, it was great.
Now, you're probably thinking that 4 books in 2 months isn't that hard, especially since they're kids' books, but as someone who didn't read any books on my own outside of school, it was a challenge.
But I discovered a way to cheat the system. I discovered something called audiobooks.
Instead of having to sit still and read the book, I could just have someone read the book to me. And I would get through the book so much faster. I'd be able to read a book in about 8 hours as opposed to reading a book never, because I would never be able to finish a book on my own. And I was actually able to understand what was going on. I legitimately thought that listening to audiobooks was cheating because of how well it worked. So I never told anyone my secret. Until just now. Please don't tell anyone. Also, I didn't just turn on an audiobook and start playing video games. No, I sat in my bed next to the CD player and followed along with the book, and sometimes I even took notes. I've wanted to talk about my love for audiobooks for so long, but I can't, because then people will think I'm getting paid by a certain company, but I'm not, and I'll prove it. Instead of wasting your money on quality audiobooks made by professionals, you guys should all check out LibriVox.org, where you can listen to free public domain audiobooks, which means there's only old-timey classical books on it, like Aesop's Fables, which, in my opinion, is all you need. Anyway, TJ and I did the Battle of the Books, and for one of the rounds, TJ was sick, so I had to answer the questions all by myself, and I never forgave him for that. And also, the whole time, I was keeping track of everyone's points, and me and TJ got the most questions right. My math skills are finally being useful. I was already craving the pizza. After the last round, the teacher said, "Okay, I'll tally up all the points and let you all know who the winner is in a couple of weeks." But since I was keeping track of everyone's score, I already knew we won. I turned to TJ and I said, "TJ, guess what? We already..." Oh, this is the round that you were sick on. How did I not notice that until just now? But then a couple of weeks go by and I'm not hearing any news about a pizza party. I was expecting to walk into class one day and there would just be a pile of pizza boxes waiting for me. But that never happened. The teacher in charge of the competition was the librarian. So one day I went up to her and I asked, "So, did you ever say who won the Battle of the Books? Also, my favorite pizza is barbecue chicken." And she said, "Oh, these 2 fifth graders won." So the Battle of the Books was for both 5th and 6th graders. I was a 6th grader, so I went to all the 6th grader battles. But apparently, there was some low-life 5th grader who got every single question right and stole my pizza party! And that taught me a valuable lesson. Even when you work hard, you don't always get what you want in life. But that's okay. Because one day,
you'll be an adult and you can buy all the pizza you want without having to read first.
Here's a little social interaction life hack I've discovered. If you're meeting someone new and you want to get to know them better, and you see any semblance of a tattoo peeking out of their sleeve, compliment it. If that person doesn't want to talk about their tattoos, they'll say, "Oh, thank you. Anyway, this is my stop." But if they do want to talk about their tattoos, their face will light up and then they'll do the rest of the talking. I realize that by giving you this advice, now anytime I compliment someone else's tattoos, it will seem disingenuous, but it's not, most of the time. I love all of your tattoos. That's right, I'm talking to you. I love your tattoos, dude. Whether it's how you got the tattoo, the meaning behind the tattoo, or being a tattoo of something you like, every tattoo is a story, and most people love telling stories about themselves. I wouldn't know anything about that, personally. I never understood why some people liked talking about their tattoos until I got one of my own. What, you think I'm gonna make a whole video about tattoos when I didn't even have any? That's right, I'm a marked man, Mom. What are you gonna do about it? Stop unconditionally loving me? Yeah, right. Wait, what are you doing with that cheese grater? Okay, but in all seriousness, can you make sure Grandma doesn't see this video, Mom? I don't want to upset her on the way out. Back in the day, tattoos used to be a symbol of rebellion and meant you couldn't get a job. No regrets, baby! But I feel like tattoos are getting more and more accepted, if not expected. I'll see a jacked, bald guy covered in tattoos and think, okay, yeah, he was meant to look like that. For me, the idea of being a badass tattooed guy with a sketch pad and a beanie and ripped jeans and a beaded bracelet always seemed cool to me. But like most people, when it came to tattoos, I had reservations. Ooh, this is gonna be on my body forever? What if I hate it? I had an idea once of getting these 5 Magic the Gathering symbols tattooed on my forearm. I even dotted them out in Sharpie once just to give them a test drive. But I ultimately decided not to get them because I was worried in 5 years I would go, oh, these? I was really into Magic the Gathering in my 20s. Not anymore, though, so now every morning I wake up with impending feelings of shame and remorse that I even decided to get this thing. And I didn't want that to happen, even though I've been playing Magic for over 15 years, and it means a lot to me, and I'm going to be buried with my Sliver deck, and... alright, maybe I should just get it. Even though people know that tattoos are permanent, there are still way more bad tattoos than there should be. One time, I saw this picture of someone's tattoo on a bad tattoo subreddit, and I thought it'd be funny to prank my family group chat by photoshopping that tattoo onto my arm. And then I thought it'd be funny to post that picture onto Instagram. I didn't think anyone would fall for this poor excuse of a Photoshop job, but then the internet and my family proved me wrong. Immediately, I started getting phone calls from my parents, and even my book agent rang me up and was like, "Did you actually get that tattoo?" "No, it's not a real tattoo." I mean, it is a real tattoo, but it's on someone else's body. That's their cross to bear. I can only imagine what that person's family and book agent went through. My parents were not supportive of me getting tattoos. But whose are, am I right? Some people, like my parents, say that your body is like a temple, and getting tattoos is like putting graffiti on it. Which, sure. Okay, that's why I paid a professional graffiti artist to paint my temple exactly how I wanted. Also, you can't tell me not to deform my body when that's exactly what you did before I was even 24 hours old. Also, Jesus had piercings, and he loved showing them off to his buddies, so I think you'd be chill with a little tattoo. After much thought and deliberation, I finally settled on what my first tattoo would be. This was going to be permanently inked onto my body for the rest of my life. I got a tattoo in Courier New. Luckily, the artist was able to finish this in one session. It took quite a while, almost 5 whole minutes. Now let me explain why I got it. It was so that if anyone ever asked me, "Do you have any tattoos?" I could go, "Why, yes, I do," and then roll up my sleeve, and then I'd go, "Ha, ha, ha." When I showed off my tattoo on Jaden's Streamathon, there was one comment that said, "James having tattoo actually tattooed onto him is exactly the kind of tattoo I expected James to have." And that made me feel really good because that meant the tattoo fit my vibe. And the second reason I got the tattoo was because I wanted to rebel. Since tattoos were frowned upon growing up, I wanted to have one just to have one. So I got a tattoo with no meaning whatsoever. Which, in a way, is the meaning. Even though the tattoo was small and usually covered up by my sleeve, I still felt anxious about getting it. And I continued to feel that way for about a week after I got it. It was a jump scare every time I saw it in the mirror, and I would look at it closely and go, "Yep, that's really in there. I sure hope I don't regret this." But then, after some time, the tattoo just became a part of me. Like, I didn't look in the mirror and go, "Yep, there's James and tattoo." I would go, "Yep, there's James. Full stop." And from that day on, I loved giving people advice on tattoos. As a marked man myself, I think you should absolutely get that Shadow the Hedgehog full back piece. YOLO, remember? What? You're worried that it's going to look bad when you're 70? Yeah, it's going to look bad when you're 70. You're 70. Don't think about how bad it's going to look. Think about how much you're going to enjoy it from now to when you're 69. I've known people my age who still hide their tattoos from their parents, but like the honest prodigal son that I am, I wasn't going to be doing that. But the next time I visited my parents, I walked into their house, and the very first thing my mom said to me was, "Do you have any tattoos?" She beat me to the punch. What? Why would you ask that? Because last night, I had a dream that you came home and were covered in tattoos. So, which one of you incepted my mom? God? I said, are all tattoos bad? Yes, all of them are bad. Even this one. And I rolled up my sleeve and revealed my massive tat. And her reaction was, ah. Oh. Well, it's not the worst word to have permanently inked on your body. Later on, she said, if you go to a Star Wars party, you could change it to Tatooine. So, I think she took it pretty goodly. Now, some of you might be thinking that my epic sleeve of a tattoo isn't that big a deal. It's tiny and can only be seen if I'm swimming or boxing or wearing a tank top. But you see, after getting tattooed, I experienced what people in the tattooing business call catching the bug. After seeing how much I liked my first tattoo and knowing that I could handle having a tattoo, I was ready to get something badass. I set up a big boy tattoo appointment with an artist I liked, and when I was in the tattoo shop, the artist asked, is this your first tattoo? Is this my first tattoo? No, sweetheart. I think I know a thing or two about tattoos. So, without further ado, I would like to debut this out of the blue tattoo. You know, from the Dark Crystal, the Jim Henson 80s puppet movie that I did a video on it years ago. Now I have the best character permanently inked onto my skin forever and ever. That movie will always hold a special place in my heart, and now it'll hold a special place under my skin. And now, whenever I show someone the Chamberlain, we end up talking about the Dark Crystal, which is great, because that's what I wanted to talk about anyways. I think I just discovered an autistic conversational cheat code. When I was getting it done, the artist asked me if there were any other tattoos that I wanted to get, and I said, why, yes I do. I wanted to get the computer from Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared, because I also love that series, and because I'm a computery guy. And I didn't realize until as I was explaining it to the artist that both of these characters are puppets. So, I don't know what that says about my psyche. I never thought that I liked puppets that much, but if anyone wants to psychoanalyze me in the comments, that'd be great. And speaking of YouTube comments, I know a lot of people are going to bring this up, so I'm just going to address it right now. You probably noticed that Chamberlain isn't holding his iconic triangle scepter. Yeah, I already know that. That's because he's holding the Emperor's scepter. It's like my own little headcanon. He got to be the Emperor because he's cool and awesome and... Come on, Dark Crystal fans. You think I don't know my lore? I didn't get the wrong scepter or anything. You think I'd get something wrong about the Dark Crystal? Okay, you want to know what happened? I own a Chamberlain statue because, of course, I do. And I took pictures of it to send as a reference image to the artist. And I totally forgot that I accidentally broke off his triangle scepter. And now, because of that, he's holding an entirely different scepter on the tattoo. But you know what? I don't care. This one's better. It's a more clear silhouette. Now, this time when I went to show my parents the tattoo, I don't know exactly what I was hoping for, but I wanted to see some dramatic pearl clutching. You know, just some real disappointment. Chamberlain had to be split up into two sessions, and I only got one done when I went to Arizona for a wedding. I saw my mom, and she didn't immediately ask me if I had any more tattoos. God didn't tattle on me this time. I told her, Mom, I gotta tell you something, privately. What is it? I need you to keep a secret from Grandma. Okay. I'm serious. Grandma can't find out about this. Okay. Look, it's Chamberlain. And I showed her the unfinished tattoo, and she went, oh, do you even like the Dark Crystal that much? I mean, yeah, the plot's kind of mid, but it's a cool world. Why were you more upset about my fake Baby Yoda tattoo than my real Dark Crystal tattoo? She didn't care, and neither did my dad. And you know what? I actually showed my grandma too, and she liked it. I can't make these people mad, no matter what I do. One of my cousins is a tattoo artist, and I was talking to him about tattoos, and my mom said, oh, you should get your cousin to finish it. And even he said, do not do that. Speaking of tattoo advice, if you're thinking about getting a tattoo, I think you should wait. Obviously, it's your body, your choice, but with the minimum age of tattoos being 18, and in some states, 16 with parents' permission, I just can't imagine being happy with any tattoos 16-year-old James could think of. All I'm saying is that I'm glad I waited and gave myself time to really know if this is what I wanted. And it was. I know you're young and you want to look as hardcore as possible, but you can still get a tattoo when you're like 23 and it'll look good. Trust me. No matter what tattoo you get, it's a way to express outwardly to the world what you like, what you want to remember, and who you are. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm about to get a full back piece of my grandma's face. There's literally no way my family wouldn't love that. Thank you all for watching this YouTube video, and now that you're all done, I'm excited to announce that I have a Funko Pop of me! If that's something you're interested in, then you can head on over to my website and you can get a signed Funko while supplies last. As always, thank you to my amazing team, and the next time I'll see you, I might have more tattoos, who knows?
So you know those books you make in elementary school that you write as a class? And some publishing company makes them into a real book so your family can buy copies? Well, when I was in the fourth grade, we were assigned to write and illustrate a short story that we would make into a book. Now, I'm pretty sure most people wrote stories about normal things, like their dog or their friends. But I wrote a story that had the title of, I Do Not Like This Family. I don't know for sure, but I bet this title made my teacher very worried. Here's what the cover looks like. Look, I'm so cute. As you can see here, I'm getting beaten up by my brother. Here, I'm being yelled at to wake up. And here, I'm looking out the window at kids having fun on their scooters, while I have a list of chores to do right here. And if anyone's wondering, I had a great childhood. I mean, I wasn't abused or anything. My parents' marriage was stable. I guess I just really hated the chores my mom made me do. But anyway, time to get into the juicy stuff. Here's the story. I Do Not Like This Family by James Rowlison. At school. Okay, class, time for recess, the teacher announced. Side note, the teacher banned the class from using the word said in any of our writing, so that's why there's a lot of awkward exclamations. James, TJ exclaimed, where is Wesley? TJ and Wesley are real people that were actually my friends in fourth grade. Wesley moved to a different school, so we lost touch, but me and TJ are still friends. He is not here. Life is different without Wesley, replied James. Wesley, if you are watching this, I am so sorry. Is that Wesley over there? Boy, is he late, TJ replied. I don't know why I made all my friends talk like robots, but Wesley responds, Hi guys, I had a dentist appointment. That is why I am so late. James, did you get my invitation? Yeah, James answered. Can you come? Wesley asked. No, James answered. Why not? Wesley asked. A reporter is coming in, so we have to clean up the house. And my mom is going to be on TV at 12 o'clock midnight, James replied. I love how I never say why my mom will be on TV, but if she's not letting me go to a friend's birthday party so I can clean the house, she's probably doing something illegal. Who would want to stay awake for that long, just for that, TJ exclaimed. And then my dear friend Wesley suggests, you could run away. Like, I don't even run away to the birthday party, I just run away in the middle of the night. I think I will, James smiled. 11 a.m., time to go, I meant p.m., but if I go out the door, the alarm will go. The escape ladder, James thought. James went down the ladder and hid behind a bush. End of page one. I'm going to skip ahead a bit because it's more of me talking to myself, but basically I get hungry, I want to eat some berries that's 5 miles away, I find a $1 bill and decide to take the bus there. 1 hour later. Where is that bus? James exclaimed. Finally, the bus is here, James replied with relief. I didn't reply to anything. Sorry, kid. Your parents aren't around, the bus driver replied, refusing to let him ride. The bus driver didn't reply to anything either. I'm 11 years old, James exclaimed. I was actually 9 when I wrote this. Apparently being 11 meant you were all big and tough and could ride buses by yourself. I really looked up to 11-year-olds. So I go home, sleep, and in the morning I hear my dad say, "It's too bad your interview on the news was canceled," Dad replied sadly. I obviously don't know what the word replied means. So I get excited that my mom's interview was canceled and I can go to Wesley's birthday party, but then I scream, "Ow," in pain for some reason. And I'm in pain, and I say, "I am going to be on my bed." So I'm on my bed, I rip up the dollar bill I found outside because I think it's unlucky. I also would like to point out that I used a semicolon in the right place. So I call my dad, who in this story is a doctor, and he says, "Okay, son, does this hurt?" "Yeah," James answered. "Oh no," Dad exclaimed. So somehow my dad is able to successfully diagnose me by only asking if something hurts. Now, I don't know how real doctors diagnose people, but I'm pretty sure it's not like that. What if 9 I's, Z, 8 S's, and then a space, and then 3 Z's. And then I write, "James said," as he fell asleep. What happens next is such a big plot twist I bet none of you saw coming. As I'm laying on my bed unconscious, my dad says, "Kidney failure." And then it's followed by 4 frowny face emoticons in parentheses. I can't believe that my 9-year-old mind somehow knew what kidney failure was. Where did I learn this? Later at the hospital, he had an operation. "He lost both of his kidneys," the nurse exclaimed. "I'll donate a kidney," James's brother exclaimed. We're almost done, guys. And then I think to myself, kidney, kidney, kidney. Those words just repeated and repeated in his mind. James could not believe his ears. His brother, in parentheses, the one who beat him up, close parentheses, liked him. Okay, so this story just turned somewhat heartwarming. I wonder what I'll say next. After the operation, James and his brother had trouble going to the bathroom. Yeah, how did I know so much about an organ that helped you urinate? Okay, last sentence. James found out how much his family cared for him. I think your family cares for you, too. Actually, I remember that line. Yeah, my teacher made me write that in.